Session number 794.
Fred Copeman, reel 9.
400, 400 and something. Both lots were 400 and something. 470, I think, the first one, 440 the second.
Was it more difficult to get the recruits this time?
Oh, yes, because there was a government, this League of Nations business about non-intervention. It meant that you couldn't publicly, you know, request people. So you just had to tell the story and hope they would turn up. Mind you, alternatively, there was the publicity all in every paper almost every day about the brigade. And Spain, it was a big thing, wasn't it? So there was more people interested in the early time. And I also did a commission while I was back. Because it was difficult to get recruits, I went all around the country and Scotland and Wales, Cardiff, Glasgow, places like that, you know, Birmingham, Manchester, Bristol, holding really big meetings. And in the afternoon before the meeting, the party would hold a commission to check up on party members who hadn't joined the battalion, who were, you know, young and healthy. I've never forgotten two of our party people in the union who were always doing their stuff. One was too ill, and the other had a big family. So anyway, they had excuses. Of course, I blew me top. I must say that it wasn't one of these vicious things, you know. It was just a friendly meeting of party members who didn't have to turn up if you didn't want to. But they all turn up. And
Does that mean that the group you took out with you were all CP members?
Quite a majority by now, yeah.
I was wondering how the brigade was recruited. You mentioned the Communist Party meetings. Who was in charge of recruiting?
The Control Commission, and that was Robson. Didn't hear much about Robson in public life, but he was a very important fellow in the party. He was chairman of what they call a Control Commission. And on the Control Commission would be Dave Springall and I think Bill Rust, I'm not sure. Maybe about three of them. Or any serious problem, political problem in the party, they took up. And they did the recruiting for the brigade. And it wasn't, you couldn't just go out because you wanted to, you know. You had to be able to make some contribution. And you didn't have to have a huge family and all that business. You know, they were checked and asked the proper questions and warned, you know, that this wasn't a cakewalk. Your chances of getting bumped off. Or, you know, it was a tough thing. They really honestly didn't just pick up people. In any case, I wouldn't have taken them out. I'd have just told old Harry, look, I'm not taking this bunch of old women out. You've got a bunch of dossers here or something like that. But they didn't. They really did it well. And Robson, who I can't say I liked, was a dour, quiet, serious fella. Never hardly ever smiled. Rather young-looking bloke. But he was very efficient. And I never got to know why all the whole thing closed up at the end of Brunetti and everybody came back, all the officers. I have a feeling it was something very high up, nothing really to do with the British party, but the Russians, who were sorting things out a bit. They weren't getting their own way, you know. The brigade kind of got on top of the Russians in Spain, politically I'm talking about. Mainly because it didn't take them long to realise that the Russians were really blackmailing the Republican government from very early on. By the time we got to Brunetti, we'd already had the showdown and got our ammunition before, you know, they insisted on seeing the stuff. But we still didn't win. Darn loons put it all in one place and it just went up in one big puff, so he just will not have had it anyway. He finished up in exactly the same boat, no ammunition. We take for granted, I very seldom talk about the actual fighting. I find it difficult because it's always very personal. Although every action started, even the almost daily over the top at Karama from Gao, which was the same old routine, they blew a whistle and two Russian tanks came up and milled around behind the lines and disappeared. And then on a fixed time, everybody went over the top and you got your slaughter and you all came back again. The real actions, you know, when you really took a position, were quite something. But because the fellas who were in them had already gone through it. There was nothing was easy. And everything was hand to hand. There was none of this artillery barrage, and you clear it out and you all go forward. And one covers the other. It's done in small groups. And you're within, you know, 20 or 30 yards of one another with the other fellas. They're the same as us. The only difference is they've got artillery and we haven't. And the trouble is you had to think of everything. If they didn't have any troops, then they had airplanes and artillery. And if they did have troops, they had twice as many as we had. And had better arms. But the individual ability of little groups of three or four fellas to take a position, just to watch them doing it, was just out of this world. Because they got over all the fears. And it became quite a do, you know. It was a personal bet we'd take this position. And it looked so damned hopeless, you know, from a few yards back and up top with two machine guns and four fellas. But they usually got them. And it was a question of just one or two fellas. One fella running and two firing. And then two running and one firing. Everything was down to small numbers, but all over the place, you know, dozens of little groups. Only in fixed position were our people in any way organized, and then we never really got them down to this idea of crossfire. Instincts of a fellow, a bloke coming, say 12 blokes coming straight at you, and you say, don't shoot them, shoot over there where there's nothing. Doesn't sound, you know, sooner or later they try it on. But even if you get a part of them doing it, it's good. The taking of the village at Villanueva de Canada, it was a whole day slaughter where we just got casualties and couldn't hit back except to take the town, one old tank, one new tank actually it was. At night, when we really got the town, the fellas went through that place like a, you know, knife through butter. And all very efficient. You see them nowadays in Northern Ireland, one on crown of one side of the road and one on the other, each covering the other. That was nature to them. Mainly because they simply interpreted in a town or a village the same procedure which they operated out in the open, which is much more difficult in the open. Money for old boot when you get in a town, just hop inside a doorway, then don't have any doorways at Karama, you know what I mean? So everything looked much more efficient. And 5 minutes was more than enough to go down the main street and take that place. I'm only telling you this because we assume a lot about the International Brigade. But if you start off from the fact these were just ordinary people, mostly politicians and poets and dockers and steel erectors and school teachers, you know, who'd never fired a gun in their life before. And the damn war only lasted 2 years. And in that time, I can assure you, the bloody Guards Brigade would have had to take their bloody finger out to beat my people because we wouldn't keep to their rules, you see what I mean? the modern army has set rules. Well, if the rules don't suit us, well, we don't use them. We interpret our own. And there's no gentlemanly conduct about it. Or everything goes. Although we had one rule, never hurt a prisoner. Never shot any prisoners in my battalion. A bloke really would have been in trouble if he'd done that. And we stopped plenty of other people doing it. Old Tito's mob weren't short of too much trouble looking after prisoners, so, you know, have a real good bust up and shoot a very lot. And they were never prisoners. The point is that they kept fighting when the others wanted to give up. We always gave them a chance. There is a... However you get into... And however tough a position gets in life, you can't throw away your national... the way you've been brought up, your attitude of fairness or toughness. And my experience was that the British, that's all the lot, the Scotch, Irish, Welsh and English, were rather quiet old bunch, but bloody tough. If you got them in a corner, you were looking for trouble. It was best to give them a chance to get away, but they never gave us any chances. So our people were very tough and a damn good battalion. We actually reached the stage at Mondecca. That was after Brunetti. Because we went to Mondecca before Brunetti and we came back to it afterwards. Then I went home, the Italian went there. When I came back, they were at Mondecca. We actually reached the stage where they had marched past any excuse to get somebody down and have a march past so we could get the old banner going and get them to sing and keep in step and look a bit smart. The devils used to have a... Every fella had his own interpretation of what he ought to wear. He'd be given a uniform and then within 2 days he would lose the top part and find a leather jacket. Or in reverse, he would lose his trousers and find a leather thing. You know, they all had something different. And the number of fellas who were privates, who were walking around with Sam Brown belts, was out of this world, you know. They just simply looked nice in a Sam Brown belt. I must say, I never drew attention to it. Something told me that if at a big meeting, when you're talking about discipline and that, I drew attention to the dress, you know, you've got a uniform, wear it kind of thing. I always felt a bit guilty. Somebody might shout out, but when are you going to put on a Billy officer? You're still wearing a sailor's jersey, you know, that kind of thing. Little things come to mind when you're trying to do big things. You can't divorce them. And you certainly can't divorce a national trait, which with the British is toughness, a form of fairness. They don't like hurting people who can't defend themselves. There's a rather too easy, you know, let a poor devil give himself up. And like at Brunetti, with that old attitude, and we found they were hiding behind a bunch of women. We lost a lot of men that way. But you'll never get rid of it. They tend to be very sentimental with prisoners. And certainly with women and kids. Give all their grub for a bunch of women and kids that come out of a village that they've taken, you know, and go without food for a couple of days just because they thought the people didn't have any, and if they'd have sorted them out, they'd find the old women got grub hidden everywhere. But that's what I found.
You said a few minutes ago that generally the International Brigade was outnumbered in battle.
Mm.
What did you think of the training and discipline of the fascists in battle?
Well, of course, the Moors were the key troops in Franco's army. Certainly where the brigade was concerned, they seemed to always be there. I think we were very lucky, the British, because that first day at Kerama, when they really gave us a pasting, which was our own fault, it was a machine gun company responsible for that, but we did lose an awful lot of men, and yet in the evening, they lost nearly a whole battalion, and they didn't know what hit them. And the Moors found that whenever they met us, they got pasting. And I think that meant they gave us an awful lot of respect. And they gave us a wide berth if they could. And quite often they could, of course. You don't have to go to the direction the fella tells you. If, you know, 3 degrees right gives you 3 miles on the wrong side of people who know over here, you get over there. But I thought they depended more on key troops like the Moors, who were good. Moorish troops don't sit around doing nothing. If they're in the line, they're in the line, and they're always looking to kill someone. And they'll sit there with a pair of binoculars and watch what's going on, see heads go by a little hole, and they'll know that's going to the headquarters, check it all out, and then they finally get set to catch them. And the number of people we lost, simply because 2 sandbags were left out of a firing front, you know. And in reverse, they would leave a couple of holes out, and our blokes would be watching, and they would hang a helmet on a string, drill a hole through the top, and hang it on, swing it past the hole, and pick it up, and swing it past. They'd do this for hours on end. There may be nobody looking, but they'd all concentrate. And then somebody would say, new troops going in, come and look, count them, see, yes, a new battalion coming in. I go, no, just one helmet, that's all it is. But it can cause a lot of reorganization, you know, just one conscientious soldier. They would be prepared to sit on their own all day in no man's land, in our own sapping trenches, which we'd, the Jankers lads had dug, and nobody knew they were there until we'd send somebody out, and then these two loons would meet in the middle. And, you know, usually they agreed that they would both come back to their own side without any trouble, and all you'd see was a fella bob up near the other trench. Now, but we're talking about a fella sitting there, you know. He was sitting there listening. Obviously, he had to be a fella who could understand English. Now, when you think of the scramble that war was, these little incidents of conscientious work to find a fella who can speak the language, and to sit there all day listening. He might hear nothing else but a dirty story, but on the other hand, he might hear we're going out tomorrow. You know, that amount of effort made really did amaze me. And I keep on saying it, I never to this day know how I was looked after. You know what I mean? I had me food all the right time. It was beautifully done. About the only one with a proper plate and knife and fork and a little thing laid out, a little tablecloth and a nice soft mattress which turned up everywhere, didn't matter how many miles we'd treat when the time came to go to sleep. The whole mattress was there, nice clean blankets. Somebody made it their business. And I took it for granted, curiously enough. I was so rushing around all the time, shouting and bawling, do this, do that, or don't do this and don't do that, that by the time I came to go to sleep, I had to go around and see they were all in the right position. And, you know, the company commanders knew what they were about, especially at Brunetti on that hill. We were stuck up on the side of the hill. You couldn't dig any trenches. And they could change position every 5 minutes to find a better rock to hide behind. And in fact, because they didn't know the angles, it was the wrong place to be. I would finish up really to go to bed. I had a sailor's instinct for cleanliness. Insisted on water in the morning to wash with, and down the river at least every other day. And there was a river at the bottom behind us at Mosquito Hill. At the bottom of that hill was a little river, lovely clear water. I used to sit there for 30 hours at night. If I couldn't sleep, I would go down and sit by the river. See how many fish I could. Try and get your mind off of the war. And working out how we could get the grub over that damn long, smooth piece of ground. And still, Franco's troops were well organized. You know, they were led well. They did the right things. Only a well-disciplined army could have stopped us at Brunetti, because there couldn't have been more than 100 troops that got to the top of that hill, but the place they put them in meant that we couldn't get to the top. Our blokes only knew that was the top, let's get there. And it's a matter of courage and drive and belief, I should have thought, but it didn't work that time. And the fact that they got within 2 days, they had searchlights a lot on top there, until at night you couldn't move away from our position. Certainly if you made any noise, light up then everybody would be shooting a bloody searchlight. The anti-tank battery were our great support for that. They were a little bit behind in a little group of rocks. There was nothing else for miles until you got down the river, except this little group of rocks. And in that were the 3 anti-tank guns, who had a good position. And then, of course, it cost old Franco a lot of searchlights, because these anti-tank guns are really good, you know, at pinpointing anything. Well, lads, that would be our nightly bet. How many searchlights the anti-tank people would get. They finally finished up having small searchlights, which they used, and the big ones, they only switched on and switched off quick, you know. The little ones would find something. The big ones would turn on it, switch on and get it, do whatever you got to do and switch off. So the chances of losing the big ones got smaller. Well, that's just proof of the ability, you see. Our people would have just stuck there with courage until the bloody searchlight got knocked down. It would have got knocked out, you see. But they did their stuff, and they'd have about that.
Were your Spanish troops, the Republican Spanish troops, as well organized as Franco's Spanish troops?
Oh, I think so. I should have thought they were better led, not in the military sense, but in the sense of real leadership. And then most of the time ours was a defensive war. And once again, when they did attack, only on one occasion did they use this modern technique of getting into lorries and just keep going, never mind the damn what you meet until you get there, to Saragossa. And that was led by, is that Canadian bloke's name? Got his picture, a huge picture of him. Not Coastler, that's the author fella. Bloke I admired a lot. Got all the way to Saragossa and must have gone about 170 miles in lorries. And was ordered back, which caused a bit of a row, because it was early on in the war. Never happened again. We should have done that at Brunetti, of course. At Guadalajara, well, they're all Italians on the Franco side. They went too far. Not all bunched up on one road, and then a few machine guns and a few old Russian chateaus, I think they call these fighters. Used to have egg bottles, egg boxes. Put hand grenades in them with a slide at the bottom. And you pull it out, they all drop down. If you, with the pins out, you see, when they go in, the holes the pin in. When you pull the slide out the bottom, all the eggs would drop, and you could get 100 in a box. So 100 hand grenades coming down from about 100 feet caused a panic along the road, you know. And that's what they did. And once the Republican Air Force caught the Italians, who advanced for 7 days, got very close to Madrid, and were suddenly stopped. The Garibaldi battalion were in that. They did a good job, you know. I found in all this different nationalities, the Italians would natter on and on, And when you found out what they were nattering about, it had nothing whatever to do with a bloody war. It was about some silly woman, artist or something in Italy, you know, that somebody had said something. They all join in. It becomes a serious problem. The Germans are ruthlessly disciplined. No individual is allowed to do anything without an order, and they do it all together. The Yugoslavs and the Slav people are quite the opposite. Hardly ever have anything to say, you know. All you can hear is a bloke give orders. That's the end of that. There's not much even talking in their sector. It's a very quiet section. It seemed to be that way. Our people were, I think, were pretty good. They were disciplined. When the time came to do it, they just did it. But they didn't expect to be that way all day and all night. So there was a kind of freedom in the British section. The Yanks were, well, just typically Yanks. In comparison with everybody else, they lived like bloody lords in food and everything else. Always thought twice before they carried out an order, which meant they always last to start off, which meant they started off having missed the biggest part of the battle kind of business, you know, but were in it and had the proper propaganda machine with that bloody loon, what's his name, him with a beard, the Yankee reporter that got great headlines, Hemingway. Well, Hemingway could get them heroes, couldn't he? All over the world, get them in films, anything. They won the bloody war the way he went. In actual fact, they were corny between you and I. But there were good fellas among them. You've got to remember, they are Yanks. They came from a country with a high standard of living. Why a fella should go out to Spain to die, you know what I mean? You've got to give it to them. And they're always full of bluff. Monaghan was one of their commanders, who I used to talk to quite a lot. And it usually got down to the same thing. What about you going over the top first tomorrow morning? That's on by you, we'll be done. I'll give you my assurance, we'll be on the top. You're enough, we blow the bloody whistle. Look round to the left, there's nothing happening. So he's lost his bloody whistle. And we're over the top getting hell again. And they come creeping up. They only get about 10 yards over and they're back again. You know what I mean? They just make a show. When you look back on it, why the hell didn't we do it? That's what I say, because the orders were so daft to go over the top in a fixed position where every bloody leaf was already shot off the trees. Well, you couldn't possibly take it without, you know, an air force or a huge artillery battery. Was just suicidal. We were just good. We carried out the order. It was a done thing. So I would have thought that, answer to your question, it depended on nationality. Looking at them, you would say the Germans were very efficient because they appeared that way. They all fired together, onk, bonk, onk, bang, all rifles, you know, in groups firing together. Our fellas, you wouldn't have noticed anything more, that nothing passed them much.